Hey, everybody. Welcome to the Faith Church Podcast. I'm your host, Jay Williams, and joining me today is Jeff Clossy.
Hey, Jay. Good morning, man.
You're back.
I am. Good to be back.
You're gone for a week.
Yeah, we had a wonderful time away as a family.
We didn't get a podcast recorded last week.
That's what I heard. I heard that this morning.
People were so confused. We didn't know what to do without you here.
Well, it's nice to be missed.
It's a good thing we remembered it was Easter.
Yeah, that's a close one.
Yeah.
I was glad to see the cross was up when I got here.
Yeah. Yeah, we got that taken care of.
We just took it down. So it's,
oh, really?
It's down now, yep.
That thing's such a beast.
It's big. That's what's so cool about it, right? The large
beams
that you look at and just, I don't know, for me, it puts me in a different place than just like a one that hangs on a wall. It's
right.
A different feeling.
It is. I remember the first time we put it up or they talked about it and I was like, oh. And then when I saw it, I thought, oh my goodness. That's really big. But then, yeah, it's powerful. I think some people liked it because then it blocked their view of me. I think that just made their day more peaceful.
Those comment cards are so helpful for stuff like that. I love that we get that feedback.
Did we get that feedback?
No, I'm just joking.
I mean, it wouldn't surprise me.
Love the view.
We definitely get all kinds of feedback.
Yeah, we do.
Usually,
what a wonderful weekend.
Yeah, it was great. It was a great weekend. And we had our sunrise-ish service, which was fun.
It was. It's funny how, I don't know what it was like for you, but, you know, we have this rhythm. All of us do, even if you're not a pastor here, right? What Sunday morning feels like, when you get up, what you need to have. And I had such a hard time like adjusting myself to, okay, when do I have to get up if I need to leave by this time to get there by this time for 7:30? It was so funny.
I mean, the good news is it's even hour. Like, it's 2 hours before our normal. So I was able to just adjust 2 hours early. But yes, there's definitely like on a normal Sunday morning when I'm preaching, I have the time that I get up. I have the time that I grab coffee. I have the time that I know I need to be in the shower by. Like, there's all these different pieces that I know. And I'm so thankful. I remember one year, I don't know, it moved to like a 45 instead of a 30. And that just threw everything off. Like, I thought.
The start time was?
Yeah, time was like,
that'd
not
be so hard.
You know, at least this was, okay, if I normally do this at 6, then I do it at 4. If I normally do this at 8:10, then I do this at 6:10. Like, I was able to at least do that. But man, when it was 45 minutes off. And then the other thing that was helpful is when you're preaching at two services, because they're both on the 30, I could kind of gauge where I was based on the clock. But again, when we had multiple services, and I remember it being like 8:45 and 10:30, and then I would have to remember, like, you'd see 17 on the clock and you're like, wait, what does that mean? Which service am I in? And if that's like, am I going long? Am I on time?
What's going on? Super hard to synchronize. But yeah, it was such a wonderful morning. And, you know, as always, such wonderful connections happening. And especially for me, that those often happen, you know, obviously before and after, but during communion, it was just such a wonderful thing to get to connect with church family. And
It was
interesting too. I wish we had a live audience that we could poll, but taking communion at a different kind of time slot too was actually, I think, a good refreshing thing. Mm-hmm. You know, like, it's good to have rhythms. It's nice to not have to think about what's coming next to be able to just enter into it. But having the time of taking the Lord's Supper after the sermon, I think was a good just change for a Sunday and a celebratory note to all of that.
Well, I agree. My internal dialogue was kind of funny because I realized in the first service, I didn't tell them that's what was going to be happening. So in a normal week.
Interesting, I didn't even notice that.
Yeah, in a normal week, one of us would get up there after the songs at that point and do a little intro to communion, which sometimes has kind of a little devotional feel to it. And I was about, I don't know, a little over 5 minutes into the message. And I thought, oh, I never told them this was the message. I wonder if they're thinking this is the intro to communion. And how great would it have been if someone's sitting there going, if that was the intro to communion, like, what?
We're going to be here all morning. Isn't there a second service?
Are we just blending in with the second service?
They probably felt fine because they knew there was a boundary.
Yeah,
can't go forever.
I suppose that's true. I don't know, but I thought that was funny. So second service, I pointed out. I also thought, oh man, I wonder if this messes with people's bathroom breaks.
It probably did,
but I don't know. I agree with you that we typically do it in the center of our service for a lot of reasons. But it's not a biblically mandated thing. So we thought this would be a good time. You know, and I especially thought because someone had asked on after the Good Friday service if we ever did altar calls. And I said, well, in a way, communion, like I was thinking, in a way, our communion, the way we do communion is kind of like an altar call. It's we're all proclaiming Christ's death and reaffirming our belief in him each time. And for some people, that is a brand new experience. And so I really, in my mind, I thought, okay, this is a message that is, I mean, we always proclaim the gospel and we always call people to respond to the gospel, but this was like a message that was very pointed in that way. And so I thought, you know, and we all thought this would be a good time to kind of have that and experience it like an altar call. And we hope, I've gotten some really good feedback from people of what their experience was like. I got a couple of really encouraging notes that God was really working in them. And I don't know about you, but like when I think about the message, I always love it when you get specific feedback that demonstrates like what God did through it. Right. So if people don't know this, like we aren't looking for the encouragement of, oh man, I love, I mean, it's not bad to say like, oh, I really like how you connected those concepts or how you communicated this. I thought was really strong or whatever. We give that encouragement to each other all the time. But the best encouragement is this is what God did in me during that. And this is how I responded to it. And I got one of those feedbacks, and that is like, that's amazing.
Yeah, that's where our hearts just are thanking God, right? We're just like, oh, thank you, God, that you used that to do that. Yeah, it is true. Like to hear something that God did that isn't the result of, you know, what music we played beforehand or what, you know, how the lights were set. You know, like it's clearly a spiritual work.
Yeah.
That the human beings don't bring about, but God's Spirit does that, is such an encouragement. Yeah, it was such a great Sunday. It was wild to, you know, we have a unique set. Like most people don't go to both services, right? And they do have a different feel on those Sundays. The second one being really, really full, obviously, this Sunday. But the first one also was so full of energy. And you made the joke at the beginning that, you know, that... you thought it would be the one maybe.
Thought it'd be the sleepy one.
But actually, then you said, yeah, but those people are up for hours before they get here. And that's true, I think.
It is true.
Based on who was there. Because it was very much full worship, just like you would imagine the 9:30 would have been.
And I do think, I remember that. I always get trapped into thinking that the first service is going to be sleepier. And I think, you know, there was definitely... I don't think it's that. I think that sometimes people who are early risers maybe tend to be a little more reserved. So in what we think is sometimes a lack of energy, I think isn't really a lack of energy. It's just, you know, the correlation of, you know, think of people in your life who are externally loud and rambunctious. Are they early risers? Probably not. Like there's kind of a cultural thing. So you realize when you get up there, I was like, oh, cause I was about to say something. I was going to say something about people being sleepy. And then I got up there and I was like, they don't look sleepy at all. Like they look locked in. And then the singing was not like they were locked in. So I thought, oh yeah, it's because they get up, they chose the 7:30 service. Cause they're like, well, why not? I'm already up. Whereas, a lot of the people that came to the 9:30, if we had 10:30, that's where they would have been, which I would be in that crowd. But anyway, so what we took a little longer there in the intro, But it wasn't as much tomfoolery. It was also real stuff. But we also started to kind of allude to the message. So, yeah, what do you want to talk about with that?
One thought I had, and this may be too obvious of a question to flesh out, but I just think given our cultural moment, you know, I love the sermon. I love the, like, the three areas, and I'd like to get into those that you highlighted that we get to receive, like the benefits and the fruit of the resurrection. One question I want to ask you, and maybe we can spend a few minutes on, is just when we say resurrection, Jesus, so Jesus was crucified on Good Friday, like we commemorate that day, and then 3 days later, resurrection. What do we, like, can we just talk for a second historically what we're talking about? Because I do think sometimes what people imagine we mean by that, or the scriptures mean by that, is different than what it means. So, well, so let me say that. What do you say?
Yeah, I'm going to flip that around on you then. Like, why don't you answer that? Because if that's in your mind, then, because there's lots of things I could.
Yeah, I mean, the thing that's been striking me about it, just my own, part of this is like my own meditations during this season. You know, I love to just really enter into the season that we're in. And liturgically, I do that in my own devotional practices. And I've just been thinking about how crucial it is to remember that when we talk about Jesus' resurrection and then our resurrections, we're not talking, this is not metaphorical. So it's literal. Like, Jesus was crucified and fully dead. So no heartbeat, body dead. And after 3 days was raised physically, like bodily and alive. And I think that's the crucial part for me, as I just think about the, like, how amazing it would have been to see this empty tomb and why that symbol is so vitally important for us. But we actually mean, and we believe, Christians believe Jesus was bodily, like raised bodily and had new life and had been a corpse, essentially, right? A dead body. And I know for probably most people listening, that's just obvious, but I think it's worth meditating on it, even if it is obvious to you, because we're basing our whole following, like our whole lives centered on Jesus, hinge on that reality.
Yeah.
Like if that didn't happen, like if you read 1 Corinthians 15 is a great chapter to read, right, about that. If Christ wasn't raised, then our faith is in vain. And then all the fruit that Jay, I love how you pulled that together, Jay, on Sunday, that can be ours, the new life we have in him, none of that's real if he wasn't raised. Not just metaphorically, but bodily. And yeah, so that's my thought. What would you add to that? Or like culturally, I just think that's important.
Well, and I've said before when I've shared my story of faith and my crisis of faith back in my mid-20s, where I was in ministry and really all of a sudden got hit with these theological crises, you know, that I started struggling and was really consumed by a lot of doubt and a lot of questioning. And for me, I kept coming back to the resurrection. And so I finally landed at this place where in my analytical, you know, genetically math-wired brain that my dear mother passed on to me, I got to this place where I said, okay, well, either Jesus rose from the dead or he didn't. And if he did, then all these other questions I have, I can say, well, I'm gonna trust the one who was in a tomb for 3 days after being crucified and walked out of the tomb. If he didn't, then all of this is worthless. It's all just philosophical. It's all just, you know, yeah, be a good neighbor and be kind to people. And, you know, it's just a life philosophy. There's no power in it. And I tried to articulate that on Sunday, and I know you weren't intending to make me feel like it was incomplete.
Nope.
But I think, like, man, when I did try to address it, it's so funny. I kept chopping things out of the message, especially for this one, because we had the kids in there with us. And one of the sections that I really abbreviated was that whole idea where I said, this can't be a metaphorical power or an inspirational power, which is what some in the Christian tradition have tried to turn the resurrection into, that it's a metaphorical resurrection, that you know, you start anew or it's an inspirational, like, look at what God can do, you know, kind of a thing, or a tapping into your inner self. And no, we, like you said, we believe Jesus was dead. And here's what's interesting about it. What I always, and at that time when I was struggling with it, and these are, if you've grown up in the church, you probably heard these a lot. But the reality is that no one really denies that Jesus lived. Like, when I say no one, I mean outside of the Christian world. So other religions, other philosophies, non-believing Jews, so like Jews who did not believe he was the Messiah, historians from Josephus, and, you know, historians in Islam, and all these, they all acknowledge that this Jesus lived and that he did some pretty miraculous things. And they all acknowledge that he was crucified. And so historically, what was so fascinating to me is that it's, you're talking about a tiny sliver that said that their argument is, well, he never existed. He's a compilation of whatever. That's almost no one says that, really. I mean, statistically, almost no one. The pushbacks, but people, not everyone believes that Jesus was resurrected. And so the prevailing arguments against it is like, so either Jesus rose from the dead or he didn't. If he didn't, what did happen? And some believe that the Romans took his body because they were afraid the disciples would try to, like, keep the myth going. And so they proactively took his body. But as is often pointed out, if they had done that, when this church started growing and creating problems for Rome, they would have just produced his body and said, yep, hey, we stole his body, you know, unless it got lost, you know, unless the centurion was like, I forget where I put it, you know, like, but they, so they would have done that. Or another narrative is that the disciples took his body. But then you have to ask yourself, if they did that, why did so many of them who would have had to been involved, why did they continue on in the faith to the point of death? You know, it'd be totally one thing if it was like, hey, they went off and they just kind of lived their life and they identified as Christians, even though deep down they were like, we know it's not real, but we're just going to kind of live this out. But that wasn't an option for them. They literally gave up everything to follow him. And they, and you'd think with all those people that witnessed him, that saw him, like, so you're talking about all the witnesses, Paul references all the way, hundreds and hundreds of people who saw him. That's a pretty big conspiracy, right? And in an age, in a day and age where you didn't even have the ability to, you know, quickly communicate with a bunch of people, like, they had to all get on the same page of like, hey, here's the story, which is wild. And then the other one is, and this is common, like in Islam, for example, that they would say, well, he wasn't dead. He was basically in a coma. He's badly wounded and then kind of recovered in those 3 days. Which, what's interesting about that one is no secular historian gives that any credibility at all. They're like, look, man, if this guy was crucified, he's dead. Like, dead, dead. You don't bounce back. And even if he was like barely hanging on by a thread, you know, and they let him down, because they prove that he's dead before they take him down. Like, Rome does not leave that in question. It's not like in the movies where, you know, you shoot a guy and then you run away and you're like, oh, I assume he's dead, and then he comes back or whatever. Like, they make sure. And so even if by some chance he was in like one of those weird deep comas where they couldn't tell, you're going to tell me, we say 3 days, but it's not like, what, it's not how we calculate 3 days. That's a Hebrew way of counting days. Like, you'd count Friday, Saturday, Sunday. So that's it. But it's actually like not even 48 hours. And so you're telling me then he pops back up and all of a sudden is like teaching to the point where he doesn't strike terror into people. I mean, can you imagine if, you know, he's asking what's for breakfast, like he's eating breakfast with them. He's talking to them. He's ministering to them. So I go through all those, because if we're going to talk about like that, those kind of evidences. And I remember getting to a place where I'm like, I believe he resurrected. And you're right. Like, without that, then he's just a martyr. He's a prophet. He's a teacher. He's a philosopher. But with the resurrection, that's proof that he's God. And I do want to make it clear. When Jesus says on the cross, it is finished, it's because he means it's finished. So the resurrection is the evidence that he is who he says he is. It's the consummation. It's not actually like, so sometimes you talk about it with a victory, but the decisive blow was on the cross. The resurrection is like, it's the victory declaration, right?
It's the beginning of the new creation.
Right. It's the beginning of the new creation. So we don't believe that Jesus battled Satan for 3 days or went, you know, like that's not, he was waiting in accordance with the prophecies and the scriptures. Like, and I think for, out of kindness for us, like, you know, if he had risen Friday night, you know, who knows? Like, I don't know. This is the way God designed it.
It is. And it is, you know, absolutely remarkable. And it's fun to think about, you know, why that's so important. And then I think it's interesting that the scriptures capture some of those, you know, objections that you highlighted. They're right there. They're actually recorded in our scriptures that, you know, the they stole the body, that all that is there. The thing that's really compelling to me, you know, over the years as I researched it and, you know, spent 13 years on college campuses talking with people who were skeptical about it, is how people like James and Paul did not believe in Jesus until post-resurrection.
Right.
So it was resurrection appearances and claims that were the linchpin for these people who doubted him beforehand, either persecuted him or doubted him. And I think that's really compelling. And it's compelling that it's in our scriptures that they had those transformations. And again, historically, people don't argue that Paul had a transformation. That is not like in question that he went from this persecutor of the church to an apostle of Jesus. And it was because of the risen Jesus that he had an appearance of him and his whole life was changed. And I think that's really compelling. If you wanted to look more into it, I mean, someone who was really helpful for me over the years is an author, Gary Habermas. He did a lot of work on the resurrection. I think the book that I have is like, I think it's called The Resurrection of Jesus or something. He goes through some of the things Jay outlined there, the objections, but then also lays out why he believes historically it happened. And there's a lot of other good resources too that we could recommend. But I do think it's so important because I think especially because of where you went with the sermon, Jay. So you talked about kind of three things then that are really ours that we receive through the resurrection, through what Jesus accomplished. And sometimes, and you did a great job of highlighting this, we don't experience those things, like his peace, for example, his power. And I think it's, for me, in my walk with Jesus, it has been important to know the truth so that when my experience doesn't conform to that truth or it feels different, I have something to anchor me, right? Because there are moments where a following of Jesus, our subjective experience of that reality, it wavers, right? It goes from, can be very intense at moments where we really feel his peace, his power, right? His life. And then there's moments where it's a struggle. It's a slog, right? And I think we all have those moments. And so to me, that's why knowing about Good Friday, what happened there, why it's so important, and knowing about Easter and Sunday, the resurrection, is so important for us so that we know how to filter that and we know what to do in those moments. So yeah, I love where you ended up taking this sermon too, because of what's to come here this spring yet, but also because I think sometimes people miss, how does it then impact my life other than I'm assured that my post-mortem destiny is assured? Because I think sometimes people just go there. Like when I die, this is what's true of me, but they miss between right now and I'm alive and I die. Why? How does it make any difference? And that's where you went on Sunday.
Yeah, that came from, I see so often, and you do too, where people are not experiencing these things. And our first thought when we're not experiencing them is either they don't exist, like we just assume, and that's when you kind of get into this mode of religion, or you leave the church. So we see people walk away from the faith, and we also see people walk away from, well, I should say this, we see people walk away from the faith and leave the church, and we see people walk away from the faith and remain in the church. So we see this in not only in our church, but in a lot of churches, and some like whole denominations have done that, where they've essentially abandoned the faith, but decided that the faith community is still valuable, and so the traditions and everything, and so they continue on in those. But they both have left the faith, and they both are not experiencing, neither one are experiencing the life and the peace and the power that come from the resurrection. So that's one thing people conclude. But the other that they conclude is God's withholding it from me. So some people believe they function. And again, when I say they believe, I'm saying how they function, right? So I'm not talking about what people will actually say they believe or what I say I believe. When I talk about belief in this way, I'm saying, but what does my life show that I actually believe?
Yeah, more than a profession.
Right. And so what I will see is then people will blame God. Like, so God's withholding from me, even though they're not participating in it at all. And so what I was trying to do was speak to that. I was trying to speak to the common refrain that I hear from people, which is I'm not experiencing this transformative power. I'm still in the same rut that I've been in. And so they are in danger of either concluding that it's not real or that God is withholding from them or it's some like lesser experience. So
yeah, reducing it.
Right. Reducing it. Yeah. That's the word. So for example, with the reduction is, someone might say, oh yeah, I've changed. Like I've gotten gentler or whatever, but their change is really more of a maturing. So it's really common that as people get older, they get, you know, not everybody, but a lot of people, just as they get older, more life experience gives you more perspective, makes you more, you know, I hear this all the time from grandparents, like grandparents very differently than they parented because it's just different. You have a different perspective. And so sometimes we credit that, but we miss out on the transformational power. And so what I wanted to do was kind of meet that head on and say, what is it we actually reject? Because if I just said, you know, in the death, life, death, and resurrection of Jesus, we have peace with God. Like, and that's what I kind of did at the beginning. I tried. What I was trying to do in the beginning where I just bullet pointed them and said, we have this peace with God and we have this life, this new life, and we get all this through the power of the Holy Spirit. I was trying to create an environment where people would just be agreeing and saying like, yes, yes, amen. And I could have ended it there and everyone been like, yes, amen. But what I wanted to dig into is saying like, but are you actually experiencing these things? And then to try to give some help as to what are you actually, like we actually reject these things. And we have reasons why. On the surface, you would think, well, who would reject peace with God? Well, somebody who wants to make their own peace, right? Somebody that wants other people to make peace with God because they feel like they're already at peace with God or they're already in line with God. They want other people to hear that or they want it to be in the past and not something that they continually receive and are in need of. And so when we look at it that way, my thought was, well, can we look at this from an angle that would kind of expose our unbelief? So that we could maybe be there with the father of the possessed boy where, you know, I believe, help my unbelief. So yes, I acknowledge these things. I believe these things to be true, but also I have to acknowledge that my life isn't fully in line with that. And so can I combat those areas of unbelief? So that was the attempt.
Well, and it's interesting. I caught those things too. I always take a lot of notes, especially because I know we'll be sitting down for these conversations. And I caught the three things. And
you like to have a paper trail for when you move from my dismissal. And on April 6th, Jay said this.
No, it's just so true that now you got me all off track.
Sorry, Jay. I'm sorry.
Everyone needed a little levity for a second. They're all happy with it.
Yeah.
All right, stop fast forwarding.
Yep.
Okay. All right, here we go. So. I do think when we have those moments where we feel like our lived experience of what we profess to believe is so different sometimes, like it's out of sync, we can think maybe this isn't real or maybe this isn't working, when in fact it is real and it does work in the sense of it functions. And this is not my analogy. I read this, but it's helpful for me and my walk with Jesus. It'd be like if you and I went to the gas station, filled the tank of gas, the 3/4 full, and then we just put water in for the rest because it's gotten expensive. And then our car starts to not operate how it's meant to operate. There's actually nothing wrong with the car. It's just designed for a different kind of fuel than we're giving it. And I think that analogy, then you went through the things that like really do water down the engine of our walk with Jesus. And it's not that that's not real. It's I think there's areas where, you know, it's the Spirit's work. He helps us to see, Jeff, you haven't surrendered this part of your life. And until you do, it's not going to be going how it's meant to go with me. And that doesn't mean that, you know, God's going to punish me for that. It's just that we're not operating with him and living with him. And you mentioned abiding, right? Abiding with him in that specific area of our life, how he designed us to and how he intends for us to. Like he wants us to experience his joy. He wants us to experience peace and life and power. And I think these things that you highlighted are ways for us to help reorient. Like, how do I put like the right kind of fuel in that tank so that I can experience it, so I can position myself for him to work? And a lot of it is, like you said, it's, have I actually surrendered? Have I actually bowed down?
Yeah. And usually so often what we interpret as evidence that God is holding out on us and is not doing this thing in us is actually the evidence that he is doing the thing in us. And, you know, so when somebody is on a hard road, they might interpret that as God is punishing me or he is withholding from me, but he's actually forming you. He's actually giving you the very thing that you want by putting you on a road that you don't want. And that concept is just, it's hard to wrestle with, but just to acknowledge it is so helpful. Like I found it in my life, it's just so helpful to even say, okay, I still don't want to be on this path and I'm really struggling with this path, but I believe that you are using this and I believe that you are intentional, you are with me and you are using this and you are forming me through this. And so I want to try to focus on that, you know?
I mean, what a different assumption for living, right? Like if we assume, you know, I follow Jesus, I trust him, and therefore my life in some way ought to be smooth sailing, right? It just, and I think it's easy to get to that place in our mind. It is. I think even if we know, like we know intellectually that that's not the case, we can still feel like it ought to be. Like if I really belong to him now and I'm trusting him, why is it so difficult still? Why are these things still going on? And like you just said, that's one way of thinking of it. The other way of thinking of it is the things that are going on today in my life are actually from his hand of love for my good and for the good of people around me, even though they're really difficult, because life is difficult. It just is. It's just a totally different way of viewing getting up in the morning and following Jesus.
Yeah, that's what's normal. So I definitely see a lot of people struggle with this when they feel like their experience is abnormal. And we've talked about this before, that what a person might say is a normal life, if you actually spelled that out, you'd say, man, I don't know anybody who has that life. I don't know anyone who is right now not dealing with suffering through illness, either for them or someone close to them. That's the norm. The norm is that illness wreaks havoc in our lives. The norm is that there's relational strife. And I mean, what would we think is the norm when Jesus says, in this world, you will have trouble? He knows and he prepares them. But also just from a philosophical standpoint, what would we expect a world to look like that was at war with God, at war with its creator, had rebelled against it? What kind of world would that be? And that's where, honestly, that flip perspective, not that we're going down the whole road of the problem of evil, but I remember just being so shaken by the concept that when, you know, that classic question of why do bad things happen to good people? And just in one moment, it flipping around in my head and saying, man, we are a world that has rebelled against God and is at war with God, even though he has made peace with us and we continue to fight against him. Why do so many good things happen to rebels against him? Like, why does he continue to pour out grace upon grace? Why do we have common grace, like medical advancements? And why do people who hate God succeed in business or have marriages that they, where they love their spouse and have children who love them and friendships? And, you know, it's God's kindness that is just constantly, you know, if he had just quote unquote kind of taken his hand off the wheel, well, that's what hell is. Hell is total separation from God and any of his goodness and any of his light and any of his kindness. And we know that here on earth, we have these glimpses, right? We have glimpses of heaven and glimpses of hell. But we know that those places are just like the fullness of either of those glimpses, right? So hell is just where people get what they want, which is to be completely free from God and to be their own God. But that world, without the common grace of God, without his constant mercy and kindness, so is horrible. Like, it's unimaginable. And so I just think, like, that kind of perspective shift of, like, it changes everything about, and it doesn't mean that you can't, that, like, we always want to make sure, we always qualify it. And I feel like you have to, because it doesn't mean that you don't grieve. It doesn't mean you don't lament. And I think the simplest example always, I go to this all the time, is Lazarus and how Jesus meets Mary and Martha. He doesn't shame them in their grief. He doesn't even say, you know, like, you have little faith, like he does when the disciples are panicking because of the storm, which, you know, you can read a tone into that. You know, I don't think he was mocking them or shaming them. That would not fit with who we see him being everywhere else. But he actually weeps with them. And I still, like, every time I think about that, I just think of how that is not how any of us would respond. Any parent who has been irritated with their child who has lost a stuffed animal, left a stuffed animal on a plane or anything like that, and just been like, oh, for crying out loud. Like, it's just a blanket. It's just a stuffed animal. It's not that big of a deal. Then we know, like, that's probably how we would respond. If we knew that in just a few minutes I was going to, you know, we're going to raise Lazarus from the dead, then the response would not be to sit and weep with them. And so I just love that picture of both that God grieves with us as we are walking these hard roads, but he also knows this is how I'm going to form you to be able to experience the fullness of life and the fullness of joy and peace, not just now, but for all eternity. And he won't settle for less than that for us. Like a good parent who just will not settle, they will discipline, they will allow their children to go through hard things because what they want for them, you know, what they won't withhold any of those things.
You know, I love scripturally, I'm blanking on the reference, maybe they'll come to you, but these light and momentary afflictions.
Oh yeah, Paul, so, you know, yeah, I consider these things, these sufferings of the world.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then he says, compared to the weight of glory. And it's interesting that he, just like that example with Lazarus, Jesus knew the outcome, right? And that those were actually light and momentary afflictions they were experiencing compared to the joy and the weight of glory that they would be experiencing shortly after he would raise him, right, from the dead. And God is like that all the time. He knows where he's taking us. He knows what he's doing. And I do think you said it in a sentence there, and I just want to highlight what you said. It is important for us as we follow Jesus to know, to have an informed imagination for how God might be feeling about the thing that we're going through, right? And you said he grieves, and that's the example, right? That's one of the best ones with Lazarus. He grieves. Jesus shows us the heart of God there for our suffering when we do suffer that way. He grieves it. And I think that's such an important, God is not indifferent to that stuff. He grieves it, even though he knows what he's doing with it, even though he knows this will be good. I'm going to redeem this. I'm going to set it right. He knows that. Yet he's with us in the middle of it. And that helps me a lot to know that. I call that to mind all the time when I'm facing that, or where I'm walking with people who are facing really horrible, painful, sad things in their life. That's what God's heart is towards them. And I think that can help us as we, like part of the point you made, I loved it with the receive his life, is that we are on mission. And part of that mission is to people who don't know Jesus yet. That's part of it. But part of it is to each other, to support each other, to all the one another's that we're called to. And knowing how God responds to that helps inform how we respond when we help each other, when we come alongside each other in moments of suffering. Because it's just a regular part of life, like we've been saying here. And I think the resurrection informs then how we do that.
Well, it informs and it empowers. And again, that's the thing is that, again, it's not an inspirational or metaphorical power. It's not like, yeah, I'm going to go do better. And I didn't get to really flesh this out again. This got kind of left out. But the way that we're formed is, I've used the illustration before that, like, if the Green Bay Packers called me and said, hey, we want you to be the quarterback. Sometimes we think of the spiritual life as like, okay, I could go and train and I could become a better quarterback than I am right now. But I can't actually be an NFL caliber quarterback. I'm not just because I'm old. Even when I was 25, I would not have been able to become an NFL quarterback. And so I think what we do a lot of times is we think of religious like activity and disciplines and growth as what I could, the quality of quarterback I could become if I worked really hard at it and had the best trainers and the best, you know, I had my own personal chef and, you know, everything. And yes, if you gave me a year training like that, I would be a better quarterback than I am right now. But sanctification and miraculous transformation is that as I train, all of a sudden my body starts to actually change and my muscles change. And now all of a sudden my tendons and everything change where I'm like, now all of a sudden I have a really good arm and now all of a sudden I'm fast. And now all of a sudden like my body doesn't ache. And now I actually become something different than I'm able to in my own strength. And the reality is, man, there, and I kind of touched on this, but when I said self-help doesn't work, I mentioned it can work in these short little bursts. Like you see people go through what we would call a physical transformation, right? They get in really good shape, but it's not miraculous. And so we can work on ourselves. Like for example, you can become more patient in how you act towards other people, and you can really work on that, and you can become a more patient person than you are right now. But to become Christ-like in your patience, that's a miraculous change. And I think people don't realize, we don't have an imagination. I like what you said, an informed imagination. So that's really important, because this isn't just like fairy tale imagination, like, oh, well, what could I imagine like fairies and elves and whatever. And no, it's informed. Imagine that's using my imagination to fill in the blanks with real understanding. You know, we do that all the time in the science world. You know, you can imagine how a flower grows, like you, because you can't watch it. You know, you can do a time lapse thing, but you can imagine what's going on. You can imagine how erosion works over time. And I think that getting people to understand, to have an imagination for who I could be. And I think one of the hard things to grasp is what is, like for me personally, just talking about myself, it's hard for me sometimes to really grasp what does sanctified Jay look like? Because sanctified Jay in heaven, fully sanctified, glorified Jay is going to look different than glorified Jeff. mm-hmm. we will still be different people. And I think sometimes I call it like the stormtrooper glorification, where we think everybody's going to end up being the same.
Just cookie cutter.
Yeah, yeah, just this cookie cutter. We'll all be marching around and like have the same personalities and the same passions and the same, you know, desires and the same everything. No, I don't think that at all. I don't think there's anything in scripture that would lead us to believe that that's the case. That there's a version of, there's the J that God created me to be that right now is so intertwined with sin and the decay of this world that I don't know. Like, I think that I will still be extroverted, and I think people who are more introverted will still be introverted. I think some people will really enjoy humor, and other people will be more serious. And I think some people will still like hiking while other people will like, I mean, there's, you know what I mean? Like, so that's what's hard to know, I think, in your own personality, to imagine myself as a new creation. What does that look like? And sometimes I think we think of it as like, oh, well, I'd be more like I might say I'd be more like Jeff. And I feel like God would be saying, no, you'd be more like the Jay that I created you to be. And so then you kind of got to go into like, is this personality? Is this sin? Is this like, what is it? But even just having an imagination for example, there are like the fruit of the spirit that everybody would have. So when somebody says like, I'm just not a very patient person, like, well, you can be. Mm-hmm. Like, do you have an imagination for what it would look like for you to have Christ-like patience, to have Christ-like kindness? Like, I think there's a lot of things that we write off as just like, well, that's just not who I am. No, that there are the universal things that will be marks of it, but my kindness will probably look different than your kindness, but it'll still be Christ-like kindness.
Yeah, I love that just thought experiment too. And we do, here's the thing, we do this all the time. Like what you're describing, we do that. We just don't necessarily do it in those explicit terms, but we work off those assumptions. We do. We can't help but do it. It like our imagination is one of the capacities God has given us, and it needs redemption just like every other capacity that we've been given. So like our thinking needs that too, right? And our feeling, I think our imagination is one that, you know, I think we just miss sometimes how often we're using it. And like you, I like that you highlighted, we often relegate it to like science fiction or fantasy, but we do it all the time when we think about like, what will today be? What will my vacation look like? What will the beginning of summer feel like? We just do it all the time.
When you order at a restaurant.
Yep.
You're imagining like yep. what this will look like when it comes out, what it'll taste like when I eat it. And that's how I decide what I want to eat.
Exactly. So we do it all the time. And one of the beautiful things because of the resurrection is even that part of us, that capacity can be renewed and redeemed. And I like that you said new creation, because that's clearly the biblical way of talking about it. It's not improved. It's new. It's brand new. And it does seem very clear that we will still be us. Like I will be me and you will be you. And that's a beautiful thing. That's a God intended thing that we aren't all exactly the same. But yeah, I love that. And I think part of, I mean, I always think of Advent as the season of anticipating Christ's work, but I do think resurrection is also part of that anticipation. Like it's where we're anticipating. The interesting thing is that we've been raised with Christ already. Like that's a fun thing to think about. Like Paul talks about that very clearly. Since you've been raised with Christ, Colossians 3, set your mind on things that are above. So like our mind, and I think that would include like what we imagine, right? What we're hoping for, what we're seeking in our everyday, just normal lives that we live. It's a crucial part of following him. So you mentioned a few things on Sunday that kind of, they end up being the obstacles for us. And I think the way those obstacles work out are different, right? For each one of us. I'm curious. I wanted to give you a chance because I know you had to cut on this one, because you had to keep it shorter. Were there any obstacles or challenges that we face either culturally or uniquely where we live that you just didn't have time to go into that you want to highlight? It's optional, Jay. You can pass on it, but.
Well, no, you know, it actually, this was actually one of those rare times where I was pretty focused from the get-go. I really just thought, I knew that it was going to be hard to convince people that we fight against these things. That the reason, you know, and I said it in the peace one, but the reason we don't experience these things is because of us, because we don't really want them. Like, we don't fully want them. And so I wanted to get people out of the idea that it's like either that it's not possible or that God is withholding it from them, and on to the idea of, no, actually, this is freely given to me. It's that I haven't set down my garbage. Like, he's just holding it out for me, but I'm saying my hands are full. I can't. I'm not willing to set this down. And so, you know, like, we talk about the life one a lot where, yeah, we just kind of, we still have this plan for our own lives. And so we kind of look to God to, we think, okay, well, if I repent and I start following Jesus, then he will bless my path. And and when you think about that from a theological standpoint, you're basically asking God to then bless your idolatry. So, like, when we would never do that with things that we know are overtly sin. Like, if you're a drug dealer and you come to Christ, and then you're really upset that your drug dealing business has gone downhill, and you blame God and you expected God to bless you in that, we would all go, well, that's probably not something you should expect. But we don't think of it in the same way when we're pursuing money or we're pursuing, you know, anything worldly. There's lots of worldly things that are not, you know, as obviously sinful. And so wanting to say, like, well, the reason why, I mean, how many times, Jeff, do we talk to people who think changing their circumstances, that's what's going to fulfill them, and trying to convince them of, like, well, but you're still going to be you. And it doesn't mean that you can't change your circumstances. And it definitely doesn't mean that sometimes your circumstances are making things really difficult. But if you are not, imagine if you really want to be hospitable and you're wired to practice hospitality and you live in a really tiny place. It's true that that tiny place can constrain your ability to show hospitality, but it doesn't eliminate it. And I would say, we used to say that about hospitality all the time, that if you're not hospitable in 400 square feet, you're not going to be hospitable in 4,000 square feet. It'll look different. But this is the concept that Jesus gives a lot, like, you know, to whom, you know, those who have, more will be given. And to those who have little, like, even what they have will be taken away. We see this concept, you're faithful in small things, you'll be given more. So getting people to buy into that idea that you're not, the problem in your life, the main problem in your life is not your external circumstances. And if you want to be different, then you have to experience that life-changing, that power in your current circumstance. Anybody, it feels a little bit like Luke's version of Sermon on the Mount. You know, like, you love people who love you. What credit is that to you? Like, you give to people who can give back to you. Like, what's the big deal? Everybody does that. And I feel that way about sometimes with circumstances. Like, you got a better job that pays more, and you, so now you worry less about money. Like, yeah, that's not miraculous change. But can you figure out how to glorify God in a job that is actually difficult and maybe not where God has you for a long time? But the question is, can you follow Jesus there? And then when you can, then you'll be able to receive the gift of a better job. Mm-hmm. And that's what I just wish people, you know, like, you're going to end up going, like, I see it. How many times do you see people start over and they move to a new place, but they're the same person there? And so they immediately fall into the same traps there. And part of me is sad because I'm like, man, I think that could have been a really great move, but you needed to experience some of that change before you went, right? So then you didn't, so you could start new. So you really, because God does sometimes in his kindness give us fresh starts, give us, you know, calls us to change our circumstances, but never to bring about the change, always to receive then the ability to, like, flourish in that change that's already taken place, if that makes sense. I mean, you probably saw it in campus ministry all the time. College is the, you know, for a lot of young people, that is the ultimate, I get to start over and be a different person. But the reality is that if they weren't already experiencing that change before they got there, 99.9% of them fall right back into the same, like who they were in high school. You know, if they didn't study in high school, they didn't just having a new, you know, a new course load isn't going to all of a sudden make them someone who's going to set aside time for that. If they, whatever they, the kinds of friends that they chose in high school, probably the kinds of friends they're going to choose in college. Now there might be exceptions, but.
Isn't it interesting that there are parts of our life, the way culturally we function, that truth that you're highlighting there is just really obvious?
Yeah.
Like it's why when you apply for a job, they ask for references that they can ask what you were like at.
Yeah.
Like we know this intuitively, but I think that our, again, we can just, I think it's sometimes it's hoping like if only this, you know, fill in the blank, if only this, and we're kind of painting a picture in our mind of what the good life or the promised land, however you want to frame that, would be. Like if I can only be there, then I would function this way. And we know that, like, that's not going to be the case. We will be who we are. And thank God then that the resurrection is real. Thank right. God then that Jesus, when he said, you know, to the man, pick up your mat and walk, the man who couldn't walk, it wasn't just a motivational speech.
Right.
He didn't just hear the right thing, so then he did the right thing. He actually experienced life-changing power in his body. And that's what's promised us, is actual transformational life change that's power from God. And it's not dependent on my ability to intellectually like work it all out, right? Or my ability to have the right technique. I'm involved. He wants to include me in it. It's amazing that he chooses to do that, right? He does. But it's ultimately his power.
Yeah.
So we don't have to be stuck. We really don't.
Well, and scripture talks about it, like we don't want to be tossed like to and fro, you know, by every wave of doctrine, kind of the idea of just bouncing back and forth because of like whatever the circumstances are. Like I know, listen, I love change. And I think that's why that's, you know, when you ask that question, like I would have loved to have gone another 20 minutes just on that idea, because I see it so frequently. Both the fear of change and the worship of the idolatry mm-hmm. of change. Like change just sparks emotion. And we either think like, I'm terrified to try something different. I've also talked to people like that. And there are people who like think that changing their circumstances will bring about the change that they want to see inside. But think about, you know, when they're out on the storms, like when Jesus calms the storm, Jesus has peace through that whole thing. And the reality is that if you, like, it's God's kindness that he teaches you to have peace in the midst of chaos. Because if your inner peace, so to speak, is determined by the peace of your surroundings, that's not real peace. That's, you are at the mercy of your circumstances. But if you're in a job that you hate and you can learn to glorify God in that, and you can see how you can honor God with how you work and how you worship him and how you love your coworkers and how you honor those who are in authority over you, even if they are not very honorable, then if he gives you the gift of a different job, you'll be actually able to receive that gift. You'll be able to actually enjoy that gift. And so either way, you have that peace and you have that intimacy with God. And in both situations, like that's the peace that surpasses understanding. That's what Paul has. And that's what he's talking about in Philippians 4, where he's been in prison. He's been out. He's been with people who love him. He's been persecuted. He's been healthy. He's been sick. He's been rich. He's been poor. He's been all those different things. But in all those things, he can handle any of those situations in Christ, because it's Christ who gives him his strength. It's Christ who changes him. Now, if you ask Paul, would you rather be in prison or would you rather be with your friends like in Ephesus? He would say, I'd rather be in Ephesus. He talks about despairing to the point of death. Like, it's not like he's just going like, he's not just a Pollyanna kind of, you know, like, hey, just greet every day with a smile and everything's fine. Like, no, he grieves about being in prison. He longs to see his friends. He would rather be in those situations, But his peace doesn't actually change. His joy doesn't actually change. His intimacy with Christ only grows deeper and deeper. And that's the miraculous thing, that's the miraculous change. So again, like Luke 6, like, so what? You know, it's through those harder circumstances, by the way, that people see what's different about you. Like, nobody questions, nobody, when somebody gets a, you know, wins the lottery, when they ask at the press conference of the lottery, nobody asks, hey, you seem really happy right now. Can you tell me why? I'm very confused by why you're so excited right now. That's never a question.
No.
It's always like, what are you going to do with the money? And like, how's this going to change your life? And whatever. You know, I watched the college basketball championship last night. They don't ask them in the post-game interview, like, hey, why are you so happy? You guys seem really hopeful right now. Why is that? Because that's obvious in the world. But if you talk to the losing coach and they're upbeat and they're joyful, then you're probably going to get the question of, you seem really upbeat. You just suffered a really disappointing loss. Why is that? And like, we know that. We know that that's the way those things go. So it shouldn't shock us that God would put us on those paths, and to be patient and to receive all things as gifts from him, because they are. And so that would be a big part of my encouragement. But like you've said before, and we say it all the time, we can't always see that. We don't always have the capacity to see that in the moment. We need help. Like, we need other people to gently kind of pull us back. And sometimes that's from just sitting with us and letting us kind of process. And then we're able to say things out loud. I've always found saying things out loud helps. Like, I start to go, oh, wait a second. That's like, if I start saying things like, I just don't think I can be happy while I'm at this job or in this relationship or in this, like, what, you know, in this house or whatever, those things should kind of raise red flags and say, well, wait a second. Is that actually true? That doesn't diminish that the circumstance might actually be really hard, but is it true that you can't experience joy or peace in the midst of that? Well, no. So then we can confront that and we can say, okay, well, what does it look like to experience, and then to have imagination for the radical, miraculous power that is available to us? Because we can't think of, like, oh, I can't imagine being joyful in this moment. Well, God gives you grace for that moment to be able to, if you trust him in it and to believe, like, oh, I actually can be. And then you experience it. And I know you've experienced this, man. When you experience peace in the midst of chaos, like, it's strangely faith building, right?
It is. It is. And it, like, you've been saying this, but it's a demonstration of the power of God, right? And for other people in our lives. It doesn't mean we fake it, right? I mean, Jesus cried out, let this cup pass from me, right? From a couple weeks ago. Like, we're honest, but we trust that God can work that peace in us in a powerful way that we really can't even explain, you know, other than to say that's Jesus. It's his spirit,
yeah.
Right? The Father's at work in us.
Yeah, well, I think that's a good place to wrap up. As always, if you have questions or thoughts, or you have stories to share, we got a couple stories after this weekend. We love getting them. Please share what God is doing. It glorifies God. It encourages the body. And it just is such a blessing. So please share that, or any questions you have, you can email us at connect@faithpeshtigo.com, or just grab us on a Sunday. We hope that this has been helpful to you. We appreciate you taking the time to listen. And until next time, grace and peace.